Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. This morning we'll have another program that's intended to try to talk about implications of results of the international war on terrorism that came in response to the attacks that happened here in the United States on September 11th. And we have tried in various sorts of ways with different people to talk about what this means. And so this morning's conversation is another in that series, and I expect we'll be talking about in different ways for a long time to come. This morning, in this first part of the show, our guest is Badruddin Arfi. He is a visiting assistant professor of political science here at the University of Illinois. And we'll be talking a bit about what this so-called international war on terrorism might mean for Islamist political movements and democracy around the world. Questions, of course, are welcome as we have our conversation, and anybody's interested who's interested is welcome to call. All we ask of callers is just that people try to be brief. We only ask that so that we can keep things moving along and involve as many people as possible, but anyone is welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. At any point you'd like to give us a call, you're welcome to do that. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Well, I'm pleased to be here.
I guess we should start out on a most basic kind of level and in a way talk about what it is that we're talking about. When one talks about Islamist political movements, and that may bring to mind for people who are listening certain images, certainly of those places where Islamist movements have resulted in widespread social change and changes of regimes and big changes in entire nations, places like Iran and Afghanistan, just to name two. But in a broader sense, really, what is it that we're talking about?
Truly, when we talk about Islamist movement, really we have to, I think we have to look at it from a broader perspective. As far as I can tell, reformers, and these Islamist movements are basically reformers, although they differ a lot on the means and the agendas and the final goals, but the essence of these movements are reformers. And as far as I can tell from the history of the Muslim world, which is about 15 centuries, there has always been movements that looked for reform within the state of Muslims. The first ones occurred basically about 40 years after the death of the Prophet Muhammad of Islam. He established the first Islamic state per se in Medina, and now Saudi Arabia. Then the first revolt for reform started in about 30 years after his death. And it has been a continuous trend in the Islamic world. But the most recent phenomenon that we are witnessing today is basically has emerged with, I would say, around the early part of the 20th century. Well, maybe late in the 18th century, early in the 19th century, early 20th century. But the same idea was there, the same essence, which is reform, to reform the condition of the Muslim society, to try to reestablish an Islamic state. But this is a very broad agenda, very wide spectrum of views, means, and as well as strategies and goals.
Mm. Well, I think that probably people, when they hear that this kind of language, we talk about Islamist movements, think about movements that are interested in establishing an Islamic state governed by Islamic law, a place where there is no distinction really drawn between the religious establishment and the political establishment. That is, in a sense, that it is all one. Now, is that an overbroad statement to say that is what the agenda is of all of these movements?
Not really. It's not an overstatement. I think the contemporary movements do agree on two items. The first one is to reestablish the Islamic State. Of course, what do they mean by Islamic State? This is a wide spectrum. And the second agenda is to restore the Muslim society to the basic values, the basic morals and norms of Islam. But beyond these two common items on their agendas, then they differ a lot in terms of means, in terms of cause, in terms of, for example, whether they use violence, whether they work within the system, or they try to topple the system itself. So, but yes, I think you're right. When we use the term Islamist, we mean that these people are looking toward reestablishing an Islamic state. But then when you say an Islamic state, is it exactly the state that was established 1500 years ago in Medina, or is it much modern type of Islamic state? And this is where you have really a wide spectrum. Mm-hmm. If you take the case of the virtue movement, or then it has changed its name now in Turkey, they are really not looking into toppling the system of democracy that exists in Turkey. They would like to work within the system. However, if you take people like the jihad in Egypt, for example, they're against the system. And then you have in between, you have Sudan, where people have been able to reach power and become part or become the system, in fact. But then recently, the president, who is from the army, has just removed them from power, basically through a white coup d'etat. You have the example of Algeria, where the FIS, that was so much on the news, was able to reach or almost reach power through elections in 1991, and then the army intervened and then canceled the elections. You have other cases, such as in Syria, where the Syrian government, the previous president, the father of this one, Hafez al-Assad, basically eradicated the movement back in 1982 by killing in a few days about 20,000 people in this movement. We have another trend or another type of movement that exists in Saudi Arabia, for example, based on the ideology or the doctrine of Wahhabism. So it's really a wide spectrum. It's wide mm-hmm. spectrum. And in terms of, I guess, a key question or a key issue is the use of violence, because most unfortunately in the news media, whenever you hear the term Islamist movement or party, they always bring with it violence. I think the use of violence is not restricted to the Islamist movements by any means. It's part of the 20th century type of revolutions. Mm-hmm. And if you take the Iranian Revolution, well, you compare it to other revolutions that happened in China or elsewhere in the world, there's not much of a difference in terms of using violence, in terms of, for example, punishing those who were against the revolution and then establishing a new type of ideology and then trying to expand the ideology beyond the borders. So it's part of the 20th century type of revolutions. Of course, they're based on certain ideology which is rooted or anchored in the Islamist or the Islamic values, the Islamic religion, and so on. But I think it's much more a 20th century phenomenon than an Islamist per se, although of course it is colored by the Islamic value system. Mm.
Well, I'm sure, just to pick up on that point, I'm sure that if one questioned people who were involved in some of these movements and raised this issue of use of arms to achieve their goals, they would immediately say that our attempts at reform have been met by the governments of our countries with violence, that they have used violence against us because they feel that we're a threat. And so they could and would easily say that they're almost forced to turn to violence in part out of self-defense, mm-hmm. and in part because that's the only way they see to achieve their goal.
Yeah, I think this is an important point, because any movement, whether it's Islamist or any communist or any type of reforming or revolutionary movement, always emerges within a context, a societal context, political context. Most unfortunately, in the Muslim world, but more specifically in the Arab world, since the era of colonialism ended, I can almost say that in most countries, the regimes have been either extremely oppressive or at least very suppressive of any sort of genuine opposition. So de facto, you're not allowed to establish a genuine opposition, whether you're a communist or you're an Islamist or anything else. So then the Islamists have to deal with this situation. More to this, the Islamist movements were targeted because they, of course, use a discourse which is very strongly attractive to the populace, which is based on Islamic norms and values. And in most of the Arab world, and I would say also the Islamic world at large, the people are still Muslims. They practice, either they pray, they fast, they do some rituals. They believe strongly in their religion, even for those who are not practicing. So when you use such a discourse to appeal to them, basically you're creating a dichotomy, and they have not much of a choice. You're with me or against me. This does not imply that the Islamist movement are not genuine in their appeal. No, they believe. Most of them believe in what they preach. But the way they portray or they advance their ideology to the people then would inherently accept them. At least I'm talking about the large populace. I'm not talking, for example, about the intellectuals, about certain sectors of the population. So given the fact that you have very oppressive governments, given the fact that you're using a discourse which is strongly accepted de facto within the populations, those regimes who do not have much of legitimacy to claim to start with, they see you as a threat. So it's a zero-sum game, basically. What you gain, I lose. What I lose, what I gain, you lose. And since they do not practice democratic ways of governing anyway, so they resort to violence. And then these movements are put into a corner. Of course, this does not imply that some of these movements do not believe to start with in using violence. Mm-hmm. That's another dimension of the issue. It's a certain understanding, I would say a historical understanding of the concept of jihad and war in Islam. And some people believe that they need to basically bear arms against the government and anyone else who stands in their ways, regardless of the conditions or any other factors. But these are, I would say, a minority within the large spectrum of Islamist movements. For the most part, the other movements have been pushed. Those who have resorted to violence have been pushed into a corner, and it became a matter of survival and an existential threat, basically. And I think the best, but it's really the worst example in terms of hardship and in terms of casualties and human suffering that has occurred is Algeria, where the FAS was able to almost reach power. It was poised to dominate the parliament through pure elections. But then it was forced into violence. How? First, by canceling the elections, the second round of national elections for the parliament. Second, by removing all the top leadership, which was quite moderate, very moderate, and put them in jail. And then came the second class or the second rank type of leadership, and they were pushed into violence consistently on a weekly basis, especially after Friday prayers. And, you know, the Muslim congregational prayer on Friday, people go to the mosque and they listen to different types of discourses, including political discourse. The army would use even tanks to repress those people who were coming out of the mosques, including everyone. Not, you don't have to be an Islamist or belonging to the FIS or supporting the FIS. And this was done for about a year or so, from January 92 to almost January 93 and beyond. And then the FIS was banned legally. People did not have any other means to survive except using violence. Of course, does not mean that one should accept or condone what they did, because basically they responded as the army wanted them to respond, because the army needed a justification internally as well as externally to completely suppress the Islamist movement in Algeria. Externally, why? Because these people were able almost to reach power through elections and democratic norms and so on and so forth. And because of this, the Western audiences, including Western politicians, had to say something against the coup. They have to speak up against the coup. This was not perceived well by the Algerian regime. So they had to justify their repressing or their oppression of the movement through a certain strategy, and it became self-fulfilling prophecy, basically.
Our guest this morning in this hour of Focus 580 is Bedruddin Arfi. He's visiting assistant professor of political science at University of Illinois. We're talking some this morning about Islamist political movements, what they are, what their aims are, and we're going to also tie that to what's happening with the war on terrorism. Questions certainly are welcome. Questions, comments. We have a caller here who's ready to go, and others are welcome to call. If you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign. Line one.
Hi.
Yes. Hello. I guess I have three questions. I don't know if I'll get through them all, but I'll start with asking whether you might be able to discuss if there's a difference between Islamist movements before the late 19th, early 20th century and the earlier ones, given that, I mean, the Arab world and Muslim world has experienced colonialism, and whether they're, you know, merely a response to internal problems or to external problems like colonialism, and you know, just what might be the relation to the West, whether it has to do with colonialism or neocolonialism or, you know, some kind of infiltration of socialist or Marxist ideas. I mean, these are supposed to be, you know, Islamist religious movements, but are they not also influenced by more modern ideas?
And this is the question?
Yeah, that's one question.
Yeah, you said three questions. Okay.
Yeah, well, I'll start with one.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is a very interesting question. Of course, it's beyond me to answer this question in such a short time. But I think you're right. These Islamist movements, they emerged, as I said earlier in the show, within certain historical conditions. And among those historical conditions was the era of colonialism. For example, the Muslim Brotherhood, which is one of the first Islamist movements that emerged in the Arab world, more specifically in Egypt, contributed very much to the not only to the internal conditions of Egypt itself by trying to change the kingdom into a republic and so on back in the 40s, but even before that, they contributed to the issue of Palestine. And they were opposed to Zionism before the establishment of Israel in 1948. And the forefathers of this Islamist movement, Rashid Rida, and then his teachers, Muhammad Abdu, and then even before that, Jamal ad-Din Afghani, were basically revolting against the era of colonialism and what they perceived as not only just colonialism in terms of political domination, but also cultural domination, and their mission was to revive the Islamic system of values, including, of course, the Islamic political system. And in doing that, they were more or less affected by the 20th century different types of ideologies, whether it's Marxism, whether it's capitalism, and they were quite very eclectic in choosing different tenets of these ideologies or methods. For example, the idea of avant-garde party, which is a communist idea, was very much seized upon by the Islamists and used in pursuing their own agendas. As a response to colonialism, yes, definitely. I mean, in Algeria, another case where you had one of the first organized movements to rebel against the French colonialism, at least as far as trying to teach the people, trying to mobilize the people against colonialism back in the early 20th century, was the Jam'iyyat al-Islah by Sheikh Ibn Badis. And this was not a political movement per se, but nonetheless, he contributed to the preservation of the what we call today the Algerian identity, which is Muslim part and other tenets also. So yes, it's a response to colonialism. It's a response to, even I would say, the post-1945 world that has been dominated more or less by the United States, but also it's much more shaped by domestic conditions very specific to any one of these movements.
Although those domestic conditions might be in part affected by outside economic pressures.
Oh, yes.
Right. So then that leads me to my third question. You said that most of these Muslim, Arab, whatever, I don't know what terms to use, regimes, did not really allow genuine opposition. And I was wondering, you know, why that might be. Is that because some of them, like Saudi Arabia, have Western support? Or is there some tradition of authority that people somehow believe that there's some father figure like Saddam Hussein who has the authority, or, you know, the caliph would have the authority?
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think this is that, or there just has not been the same Western kind of structures and traditions and institutions, and you can't just plant them in overnight?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think this issue, of course, has different dimensions, but one which is quite important is the way that the specifically the Arab states were formed in most of them post-1945. In the Middle East and North Africa, these states did not exist before the era of colonialism. So the borders that we have today were basically put down on a piece of paper by the French and the British. And then these regimes that emerged from that process lacked a strong sense of legitimacy. Mm-hmm. So they had to build enough legitimacy for the state, not just for the government, even the state. And one of the challenges that faced the Arab world was whether to, after the fall of the Ottoman Empire in 1924, was whether to form a single state for the whole Arab world, and that was the ideology of pan-Arabism, or to have different states in different parts of the Arab world. And this remained a challenge to the states. So the states had to engage into what we call a process of state formation. And in order to build legitimacy, it led to an existential dilemma for these regimes. Of course, I'm not condoning the ways that they did this. They could have done it otherwise. I mean, they could have used democratic means and so on. We have the example of Lebanon, for example, which has been a very democratic state since it emerged in the early 20s, under the French mandate system before it became independent in the 40s. So the others used oppressive means as a way to consolidate the regimes and to perpetuate the state against different challenges. The pan-Arabism was one challenge. The armies were always one challenge. And also they had to deal with the external world, especially after the beginning of the Cold War in 1947, and then the superpowers trying to penetrate the region and to impose their own logic on the region. All these challenges were at the same time constraints as well as empowerment for these leaders. For example, if you take Egypt as a prominent case, Jamal Abdel Nasser played the card of the Cold War to suppress internal opposition and vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so then I guess I'll come to my second question and then hang up. I'm thinking about Israeli policy, especially in the last week, and how that is possibly going to affect, not that it's new in the last week, but it's particularly virulent, and there's been a lot of some kind of a disinformation program, I think, on the part of the Israeli and the American government. But what do you think the effect of trying to humiliate and disable someone who's supposed to be your partner, and how is this going to play among Palestinians or in the Arab world or among Islamists when they're told that the war is not against Muslims and that kind of thing?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the Palestinian-Israeli issue is a very tough one, and that's why the world cannot solve it easily. So I won't be able to explain it quite easily. But there is a number of factors that should be taken into account when talking about that issue. One of them is that now we are those people are employed on both sides of the conflict in a self-fulfilling prophecy. The Israeli government, led by Sharon, is doing what it is doing, and it's just self-fulfilling itself, trying to put Arafat into a corner and then demonstrating to the world that this is not a valid partner to talk to. But then, well, this how did the process started? By your own policies. Vice versa, when Hamas and Jihad and the other groups, they carry on their suicide missions, they undermine the authority of Arafat, and then they tell the Palestinians, see, well, this is not a good leader. So they're just self-fulfilling their prophecy. And these two extreme positions into the spectrum of the issue are just driving the logic of the game. And that's why it's extremely hard to find at least a solution in the short term.
Well, I appreciate the questions of the caller. Other folks are welcome to call with questions, comments, 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And again, to introduce our guest, we're speaking with Badruddin Arfi. He's visiting assistant professor of political science at University of Illinois. You talked about the Islamist movements as rising in part out of an effort to reform their own countries and their own governments and their own societies, and perhaps being interested in that, and maybe in a slightly larger sense, you know, they have regional concerns. Very clearly also, though, going back some time, these movements have also been there to respond to or have reacted to European powers coming in to the region and drawing lines and doing what they might consider to be interfering. We, I think, here in the West, looking at these Islamist movements, view it through our lens and see only what that means for us and for the West, and see them. I think we don't really understand exactly their local or their regional context. We just see them as being anti-Western, and for that reason, consider them to be a threat. How now or in what sense is a reaction to the West, Western values, a part of these movements or an important motivating force to people who are involved in these movements?
I think to be fair to the Islamist movements, we cannot just put them, all of them, into a single category. If you take someone like Hassan al-Turabi, the leader of the Islamist movement in Sudan, even though he's portrayed here in the State Department as a terrorist, but he's, I would say, quote-unquote, very much westernized. He has espoused most values of the democratic way of politics. In fact, he graduated from the Sorbonne in Paris. He has a PhD in international law, and he's very fluent in different European languages, and he's traveled a lot in the Western world, and he's a very fluent speaker. Another one is Al-Ghannouchi, who is one of the leading Islamist people in Tunisia. Now he's exiled in Britain. He cannot go back to Tunisia, but also he has espoused most of the modern values of the democratic system. Of course, this does not imply that others have done so. So I think the most I would dare to say that most of the Islamist movements are not anti-Western per se. They're anti-foreign policies, if I may use this term. One of the problems that I've been living in the West for quite some time now. I've even got some gray hair here. One of the problems here, it's good. It's part of the democratic system that people trust their government. But also, a vibrant democracy should not believe in the people, but should believe in the institutions. That's what the forefathers said for this country. And politicians have different agendas. not all those agendas, as we know for from many episodes in the history of this country, you take the Nixon administration, the Johnson administration, many administrations, politicians have different agendas. They have some hidden agendas, personal agendas, as well as national agendas. And it's very hard to differentiate between the two because it's the same person. It's in the mind of the same person. So the Islamist movements, most of them are against the policy of interfering that, for example, the U.S. administrations have had in the Middle East and elsewhere in the Muslim world. And why is that important? Because these movements are engaged into a survival, an existential struggle with their governments, and then at least apparently who is supporting those governments, those regimes? It's the United States government. So the friend of my enemy is my enemy. That's the logic. And vice versa, by the way, for the U.S. administration, even though any administration, any president has hundreds of advisors and so on and so forth, but the way they play politics at the international level, they portray things as being a zero-sum game. They understand that there are so many nuances among these Islamist movements or in any single country, but as long as the U.S., what they believe or they define as being the U.S. national interest is at stake, then anyone who goes against that is against not only the U.S. administration, now they're portrayed as being anti-Western. And this reminds me of the President Bush speech at the Congress after the September 11th events, where he basically tried to redefine the international political discourse as a zero-sum game. You're either with us or against us. That's fine. Who defines us? What us means? Is it what the Bush administration means? Or is it what the Congress or the people at large? Do we have a national debate which is supposed to be part of a vibrant democracy? And by just dividing the world into us versus them, then you don't give much choice to those people who are not against your values, but maybe against your policies.
I wanted to bring this back to the issue of how governments in countries where there are Islamist movements have responded to those movements. And you have talked about the fact that in some cases, some governments have used violence to put those movements down. Now that we have this, what we're calling this war on terrorism going, is there the concern that places where they have used violence against these movements will feel even less constrained than in the past because they will say, well, there are these people that you think are terrorists and will support you in the effort against them, but then there are these people that we think are terrorists, and if we may not be looking for you to support us, but at the very least we're looking to you to not criticize us for whatever we do at home, because we say this is our territory, these are our problems as we define them, you define your problems as you do, we define ours as we do, and everybody's going to leave everybody alone to do what they want. I mean, is there that kind of concern?
Well, most unfortunately, it's not just a concern. It has already happened. And I can give you two instances in Egypt and in Algeria. The Algerian president was received here in the White House, I think, twice this year. The first time he came, he had about a 15 to 30-minute meeting with President Bush. That's President Bouteflika. And they talked mostly about the oil industry and other economic issues. This was before the September 11th. Then he was invited after the September 11th and to talk about the coalition against international terrorism. And what's the Algerian press, which is very much a constrained press, a very manipulated, if not controlled by the state and the generals and the army and so on, the argument that has been proposed in that press, which, by the way, portrays itself as being free, but it's very syndicated type of press in one way. The argument that has been proposed is, You see, we've been telling you for 10 years that these people are a threat to everyone. We've been fighting them, but you more or less accepted them in your countries. You gave asylum to their people. You gave them a forum for proposing or at least propagating their ideologies and so on. Now we are vindicated. You see, we've been telling you for 10 years. And also in Egypt, the same thing has happened. The Egyptian government has been engaged for about 10 to 12 years now against some, not all Islamist movements, but it represses all Islamist movements. But one specific Islamist movement that has resorted to violence is jihad, which is not related to jihad in Palestine. They have been fighting a survival war on the side of the jihad movement with the government. But now, about 2 weeks ago, I heard the Egyptian foreign minister, and he was making this argument precisely. You see, President Mubarak has called for a conference against international terrorism many years back, but you guys in the West refused, and in fact, you ended up harboring those terrorists. Of course, for the Egyptian government, any opposition group is a terrorist government. And we've had, for example, here in the United States, there is so much debate concerning the trying those people in a military tribunal. Egypt has been doing it for 12 years now. So now they're telling, see, we've been doing it first. Now you're learning from us. And I think the impact of this on all Islamist movements will be just very serious. You're not allowed anymore. But basically, de facto, you're a terrorist. You have to justify that you're not a terrorist. Innocence is not the presumption. Guilt is the presumption.
So it would not be unreasonable to think that what would likely result would be more violence, not less, and that if these groups see the United States standing beside their governments, and if they're opposed to their own governments, then they're going to be more anger, at least, if not violence, directed at the United States.
To some extent, yes. But those people need to have resources, and they need to have a base for operation. Mm-hmm. That base will not be found anywhere in the world now. That's my prognosis, at least. Their people are being pursued in Europe, not really in the United States, because we don't have many of those groups. But in Europe used to be the safe haven for those groups. All Islamists, I'm not talking about those who have resorted to violence, any opposition Islamist groups. Now they're being basically pursued by different, either the legal system or by their own governments, and they don't have a safe haven anywhere to go. And those resources are needed for any type of opposition, any type of opposition. Whether we'll have an increase in violence, I doubt it very much. Maybe it's just the opposite. Violence or legalized violence by the governments against those groups without any international actor raising a voice of concern.
We have a couple of other callers. We have somebody here on cell phone. I want to get them here, right here, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question. This may be a simplistic view, but as far as the political movements, they seem to be all aimed at or backed with Islamic in mind, you know, religious movement, from my view. But should their political movements maybe shift more to economic for their countries, the Arab countries? In the sense that, from one point, I see these Palestinians throwing rocks and rioting in a street. These are all young men. And in the United States, you don't see young men out in the street throwing rocks and rioting. They're working. They're all working. They have something to do. Maybe the political movements are, maybe should have more separation of church and state, and maybe they're hung up on their political movements are mixed too tightly with their religious views. Could you comment on that, please?
Yeah, thank you very much. I think you're right. This is an important question. However, let me briefly answer this question, if I may. For any economic system to thrive, you have to have stability. If you have turmoil, if you don't have stability at all, if people fear for their lives, of course they cannot engage into economic ventures. I won't answer the issue of the Palestinians and so on and so forth. That's a different issue. But for the Islamist movements, many of these do have economic programs. They don't just have political programs. Take the example of Turkey. The Islamist movement in Turkey is almost as old as the as Turkey itself as a country. It was even able to reach power in the early 90s through elections and within the system. But then it was pushed by the army bit by bit to not only leave power, but also they were suppressed. They were prevented. They were banned as a political party. They reorganized themselves in another political party. They were banned a second time, and then legal proceedings are being undertaken against them for the third time. And of course, this party has an economic program. Another example is in Sudan, where the Islamist political party also, they do have economic programs. They're concerned. In fact, in practical terms, they've been able to provide a lot of social welfare for the people than their own regimes. And including, for example, you mentioned the case of the Palestinians, Hamas, which is originally was a pure social welfare type of movement. They have been much more effective than the Arafat authority, the Palestinian authority, in providing welfare for their own people, economic welfare and other types of welfare. So, and in Algeria also, the FIS was able to do a nice job in providing certain types of markets that were subsidized. And so there is a concern, but I think that the problem is when you don't have stability, when you're not allowed to exist, when you have an existential threat, you don't have much choice of thinking about economic programs. If you're allowed to run for elections, yes, you have to give your economic program. But if you're just engaged into a struggle of existence, I would believe it's very hard for anyone. Of course, I'm not apologizing for anybody. I'm just stating facts here. And this is how it's happening in the Islamic world.
We just have about 6-7 minutes left. Our guest is Badreddin Arfi. He's visiting assistant professor of political science at the University of Illinois. We have two callers. Next in line is Charleston, line 4. Hello.
Yes. I wonder if your guest might address the issue of the Leninist view of imperialism, which becomes the object of all of our social present social institutions. And how does this play out in the individual institutions such as religion, politics, and economics, which the goal, in my understanding, of most human activity is to reach one's goals, no matter how they affect the indigenous peoples or established entities such as the Islamic world and others, and capitalist imperialism, in my view, now has taken precedence over everything. But other institutions still project themselves towards whether it's religion and heaven, or if it is imperialism in politics and economics, and this push by all social institutions seem to drive themselves toward this imperialist or this heavenly view of even under capitalism, you know, well, if we can just get worldwide capitalism, well, everybody will be just fine, which is patently untrue. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much. Of course, this is a very important as well as difficult and wide question. But I think that from my understanding, both Leninism as well as capitalism, they do miss the dimension of in which these people believe, which is the religious dimension. Not everything can be explained by economics or by the material conditions, to go back to Marxism. So there is the sense of worth or the human values do have an impact in our daily lives. And most of these movements believe that religion should not be explained in material terms, and also they believe that it should not be opposed to material terms. It's not in a competition. The two basically feed into one another and sometimes reinforce and sometimes undermine one another.
Try and get one more. Champaign County, here, line one. Hello.
Hi. Regarding to the question about why are all of these politics framed in terms of religion, I think we have a couple of very graphic examples that aren't, well, one of them is commented upon, is that the U.S. recruited the most zealot, full of zealotry, and the most radical Islam to fight the Soviets, and there's actually some evidence that it was purposely instigated to be Russia's Vietnam. But the other example that maybe is also maybe is less widely commented on is that the Israelis were funding Hamas when the PLO was seen as the major enemy, and they were using the Islamic Hamas movement as a counterbalance to the secular politics of the PLO, and now, you know, reap the wind or something. But
I think we better get a comment.
Have a chance to respond to that. Yeah. It's hanging in the air. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure about the second thing that you mentioned concerning Hamas being funded by Israel, but as far as the other one that the U.S. contributed to the emergence of those people in terms of resources, yes. But the thinking, the ideology existed already there, and it's not a surprise that those groups thrived because they had a message, they had an ideology that appealed to the population, and maybe here in the news you hear about these people because of what's happening in Afghanistan these days, or happened during the Cold War and the Russian war against the Afghan people and so on. But Islamist movements have existed before, during, and after the Cold War. They have been shaped by that logic, by that conflict, but it's not really the U.S. that had prompted the emergence of this. It was much more an internal, domestic reaction to domestic conditions as well as international upheavals near the end of the colonial era.
We are going to have to stop there because we've used the time. We want to say to our guest, thank you very much.
Thank you to have me here. It's been a pleasure.
Badruddin Arfi, he is a visiting assistant professor of political science here at the University of Illinois.